I used to walk around and say, I don't judge anyone except Christians.
I remember a magistrate saying, you're not listening to anything we're trying to do, you're going to prison, son.
People are mysteries and also infinitely valuable in that way.
Then they tell you you'll probably be dead within 27 months.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to The Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
There are around 22 million people in the world today who are refugees. There's probably actually a lot more than that, but this is the number of people who have recognised refugee status. And trying to picture what 22 million people looks like is hard. I was thinking about this, and where I usually see crowds is like a cricket game or a football game. And in Australia, our largest stadium is the MCG in Melbourne. It holds 100,000 people. We would need 220 stadiums like that to seat all the refugees in the world.
The needs are overwhelming. And there are a lot of organisations out there trying to help. Refugees are some of the most obviously vulnerable people in our world. You know, imagine being part of an effort to organise food, shelter, clothing, a safe place to sleep for tens of millions of people. And that's before we even get to emotional and spiritual needs.
Erin Wilson is an Associate Professor of Religion and Politics at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, and she's one of the editors of a recent book about religion and the refugee crisis. Erin's been into CPX before, and on this visit, we began by asking her to describe the scale of this crisis.
It is. It's huge. It's unprecedented in terms of global records. So there's 65.6 million people currently displaced. That's from the UNHCR's Global Trends Report, which was released on World Refugee Day this year. And of that, there's 22 million people who are classified legally as refugees, up to 10 million people who are stateless. And that's a low estimate. And it's just staggering numbers, really.
And most of these refugees have ended up in developing countries.
Yeah. Again, UNHCR Global Trends Report this year, 84% of refugees are hosted in developing countries.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, it's huge, and it's something that we often forget. The Global Trends Report actually lists the top six hosting countries. Number one is Turkey. Lebanon and Jordan feature in the top six as well, but none of the top six are developed nations. So it's all developing countries.
And tell us about the implications of that.
Well, a lot of the reason why developing countries are the main hosts is because people flee conflict, they go to neighbouring countries. So a lot of the conflicts are taking place in countries that are less developed, and so people are fleeing to countries around that. But what that means is that you have countries that have very poor infrastructure, or they have the rule of law is not so great, or poor resources, all these kinds of things. And so you end up with situations where people are living in very precarious situations. It's all temporary. They don't know how long they're going to be in these camps for. There's a lot of security issues around safety for women, for children, even sometimes for young men who are travelling by themselves. And it creates this real situation of danger and uncertainty for people.
Are they welcome or unwelcome in those countries, broadly speaking?
A bit of both. Particularly if we're talking about the Syrian conflict and the refugees from Syria, the initial response was, yes, you're welcome. But the longer that people stay there and the more protracted the situation becomes, the more issues that there are, the more resentment that is created because refugees are receiving support that local people don't have access to. And that starts to create tensions.
If you've fled your home, you're going to have a lot of these, you know, practical material needs. What about spiritual needs? Are those relevant at a time like this?
Oh, absolutely. But one of the interesting things about the humanitarian sector is there's quite a bit of wariness, I guess is the best way to put it, around religion and religion's place within humanitarian responses. So there's a perceived capacity for religion to be abused or as a way to manipulate people. And so the attention to religion has, up until recently, been fairly minimal. And even now, like, we start to see more secular humanitarian actors engaging with religious actors, with religious local faith-based communities. But there's still not as much attention to people's own spiritual needs when it comes to dealing with, for example, trauma that they've experienced as a result of conflict and the ways in which their own belief systems or worldviews may be disrupted as a result of the displacement experience.
Yeah, a lot of refugees talk about when they come to Western countries, a bit shocked at the lack of a religious sort of sensibility in the place they find themselves, don't they?
Yeah. A friend of mine who is she's a former refugee from Pakistan, and she spent 5 years in an asylum centre in the Netherlands. And she was telling me that there's no religion in these places. And she said, coming from somewhere like Pakistan, where spirituality, religion, the ideas of the transcendent kind of permeate the public sphere there, it's something of a culture shock to be in this environment where there's literally nothing in relation to religion.
What do people think is the role of religion in the current crisis, and is it accurate?
I think there's a lot of different opinions. There's a lot of confusion about the place of religion in the current crisis, but from my reading of other research and also of public conversations on this, I think the assumption is that most refugees are Muslim. They're coming from countries that where Islam is the dominant religion. And so there's this perception that refugees are Muslim. That's inaccurate to start with, because there's a lot of refugees who are Christian and Yazidi and Baha'i and Druze, and a lot of them are also atheists. And so there's a lot of different identities at play when we look at the refugee community. And the other problem, of course, is when you the assumption that all refugees are Muslim, there's this idea that there's only one way to be Muslim.
Yeah, so people may or may not be Muslim. There may be a certain type of Muslim and not another type of Muslim, and it sounds very complicated and hard to get people to talk about in a sensible way.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, even if you do identify as Muslim, that may not be the most important part of your identity, or it may not be the most important priority for you when you're being resettled or when you're in a context of displacement. And so this treatment of Islam and being Muslim in this very singular kind of way doesn't allow us to see the complexities and the needs of the refugees.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
An idea that comes up in discussions around the refugee crisis is this one. Refugees are typically fleeing countries where religion is overt and oppressive, and they're fleeing to secular Western countries where religion is private and there's a separation of some kind between church and state. Or, to put it more crudely, that religion is the problem. It's what causes division and conflict. So what connection is there between religion or faith and war and peace?
I think a lot of it depends on how you define conflict. I think to say that Western societies may have less mass violence, but there's still, I mean, the United States, for example, gun violence is still a huge problem. Domestic violence is an enormous problem in Australia as well as in the United States and in Europe. And I think talking about conflict in these terms is unhelpful. There's also this kind of implicit assumption that religion is somehow the source of all conflict. And that is a big assumption that's made in a lot of Western societies. What that forgets is that religion is often also a source of peace. It's an inspiration for people to engage in peace-building activities. The other issue with that too is it creates this artificial distinction between religion and secularism, and this idea that you can actually clearly distinguish between what is religion and what is secular. And that's actually quite difficult to do. I mean, if you ask someone to define religion, they often talk about religion as being a belief in God. But then where does that put Buddhism? Because Buddha is not considered a god. So how then do you define it? It might be a worldview or an ideology. Well, then you could say that Marxism is a worldview or an ideology. So I think putting it in those kinds of terms is just unhelpful for understanding the situation. And it also leads to this idea that religious people somehow don't adapt and they don't change. And so these people are coming from a religious community to a secular community, and that's going to cause problems when religion is highly dynamic, people are highly dynamic. And what we should actually be talking about is not religion and secularism, but people.
It's a very tricky one, isn't it? Because I can understand why the secular person says, just keep, you know, the religion seems to cause some of this conflict, why not just keep it private? But to the devout religious person, that's kind of an incoherent thing. They think everything about their faith permeates every other part of life and has some public implications. And I guess it's important for the religious person to convince everyone that what their public religious impact will have is a good impact. And that's a bit of a job to do, right?
Yes, but I would also say that that's in a sense an unfair burden. So it should be about communication. Secular people should be trying to understand why and how religious people see the world in particular ways and how that motivates them to operate in particular ways. And I think it's also important for us to recognise that secularism is not universal and it's not neutral in the way that we've often thought about it. Secularism developed in a very culturally specific time and place, and it emerged out of a particular set of experiences. And that colours the way that it operates in the world. It's also something that doesn't make sense in a lot of other contexts. The whole idea of religion as something that can be clearly identified and distinguished and sort of marked out from other areas of human activity is a very modern Western invention. Prior to colonialism, Hinduism didn't exist in India, as an example, because it was just the way people understood
that's
the world.
That's life.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
What about the role of religion in terms of the organisations who are providing support and relief to refugees? Are religious people particularly involved in this work?
Yeah, there's a lot of faith-based organisations that are part of responses both on the ground in the immediate humanitarian emergency context as well as in developed countries. And they come from a variety of different faith backgrounds. There's a lot of Christian organisations. There's also a lot of Muslim, Buddhist organisations, Jewish organisations, a lot of humanist organisations as well. So they're very present. A lot of them are very well respected in the humanitarian sector. There are some that are viewed with some concern. But
why is that?
Well, there's a perception that they are trying to take advantage of people who are in vulnerable situations in order to convert them to a particular religion. But what is also often forgotten in these conversations is that refugees are very resilient people and they do have their own sense of agency. And what you find is in some contexts people are taking aid from different organisations of different religious backgrounds and they're just doing what they can to help themselves. So they're not being taken advantage of and they are actually able to use these opportunities for their own benefit. So it's a complex situation.
What do you think makes a good religious organisation in that context?
Well, the most important thing for an organisation when they're dealing with refugees is that they're focused on the people. What are their needs according to them? Not making assumptions about their needs based on what we perceive, but actually engaging with them and asking them, what do you need? How can we help you?
Have you seen some good actual examples of what you're describing?
There was an organisation that we interviewed in Jordan recently that are going into the camps there and providing assistance, and they provide opportunities for kids to play soccer, for example. And for kids in these situations, a lot of they've lost their favourite toys, they've had to leave home, and they don't understand why they've had to leave home. And so this organisation goes in and they just organise a soccer game. They don't talk about religion. They don't try and teach the kids anything about a particular faith system. They just let them play a game of soccer. And I think that's
no small thing.
Exactly, yeah.
What does it look like when this works well? So when people are resettled, what we might call successfully?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different ways that looks. But I would say, first of all, that people are happy, that they are at peace within themselves and with their family and with their community, that they have opportunities to live a fulfilling life in dignity, whether that's in employment or whether that's having their family with them, being able to be with their loved ones, serve their community through volunteering, and feeling like they are accepted within the society. So not hearing negative things about their community in the media or on television, for example, and feeling safe and being able to walk down the street without being worried they're going to be abused or discriminated against.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great vision for everybody,
yeah,
isn't it? I think you resist this idea of we should welcome asylum seekers because they'll make a great contribution to our society. What's the problem with that idea?
It's a well-intentioned argument, and I completely understand why a lot of refugee advocates make it, because we want people to see that refugees can and do make a contribution to our societies, making our societies better, and of course they do. But what happens to the people who can't? What about someone who is so traumatised from their experience of war that they will never be able to work, that they will never be able to volunteer? Is that person not worthwhile? Is that person not valuable? That's my concern with that argument, is that we say, okay, well, you're disabled, you're mentally incapacitated, you're too depressed and too traumatized, we can't take you. What happens to that person? And they matter as well. They have value. And I think we need to shift the argument so that we can see that.
How do you make the case for, you know, the basic idea that we all have a responsibility for one another, that nations ought to be accepting asylum seekers in the first place?
I think at the heart of the matter, there's a very simple question, and it's whether we're prepared to see these people as the same as us, as deserving of the same kinds of quality of life and well-being as we are. And if we are, then we need to take responsibility for that. If we're not prepared, if we don't think that they deserve the same quality of life that we do, we should also be prepared to admit that and accept the consequences of that. And those consequences are not just political and economic, but they're also moral consequences.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore.
Erin Wilson is co-editor of a book called The Refugee Crisis and Religion, Secularism, Security and Hospitality in Question. If you want to read more on this topic, it's a great place to start. We'll put a link to it on our website, publicchristianity.org.
We're on Facebook and Twitter. Search for Centre for Public Christianity. And if you want to listen to us online, you can find this conversation and more on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us.
And if you're listening on iTunes, do take a minute to leave us a rating or review. It helps people discover our show.
Next week,
the keeper of the Holy Quran, the religion minister, took hold of the Bible and looked at it and he said, I know exactly what this book is. I've been praying to God for years that I could read this book. Thank you for bringing me this book. I'll read it every day.